it's a happy story in the sense that, I mean, I survived it. And the way I survived it was I retreated into my own internal world. I wrote in journals all the time. I carried these spiral 5-subject notebooks, and I would just focus on the page and write what was happening to me. When things are that catastrophically terrible in your life, there's a certain point where, you know what, it's just funny.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. There's no halt to the altar in Massachusetts. South Africa mourns the passing of its BIPOC griot, and the horrifyingly hilarious queer life of best-selling author Augustine Burroughs. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Dean Elzinger.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending May 15, 2004. A last-gasp legal move to stop Massachusetts from performing the United States' first legal same-gender marriages failed this week. Earlier attempts in the state court system to stay the state's highest court's November decision for marriage equality were rejected, so its opponents turned this week to the federal courts. Conservative legal groups based in 4 U.S. states filed on behalf of Massachusetts Catholic Action League and 11 state legislators. They argued that the state's Supreme Judicial Court had overstepped its authority in reinterpreting marriage to include gay and lesbian couples. U.S. District Court Judge Joseph Tauro disagreed, affirming the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court's authority to resolve state constitutional issues with finality, including the interpretation of marriage. The plaintiffs immediately turned to the First U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, which upheld Tauro's finding and refused to stop the marriages from taking place. That appellate court did agree to hear further arguments in June, after hundreds of marriages of same-gender couples will already have taken place. The plaintiffs took their case to the U.S. Supreme Court, which this week declined to take it up. As usual, the nation's highest court did not comment on its refusal.
While Massachusetts marriages are expected to spawn many lawsuits and headaches for benefits administrators, the biggest question at the moment is the status of non-residents. A 1913 state law prohibits marriages that would not be recognized in the couple's home state, and Massachusetts Republican Governor Mitt Romney has vowed to veto any bill to repeal that law. State policy for decades had been to ignore that statute, which grew out of the historic controversy over interracial marriages. Massachusetts marriage license application forms include an oath that non-resident couples know of no legal impediment to the marriage in their home state, and Romney's administration has backed down on requiring any additional documentation. The governor has threatened legal action against any clerks who issue licenses to gays and lesbians who are not and do not intend to become Massachusetts residents, but at least 3 communities intend to defy him: Provincetown, Somerville, and Worcester. The law provides for up to a year behind bars and a $500 fine for officials who issue a license knowing that parties are prohibited from marriage. Couples who lie on a marriage license application are liable for a fine that's just a small fraction of those for lying on other legal documents. Massachusetts judges have been given wide discretion on the residency issue in determining whether to waive the normal 3-day waiting period between licensing and contracting of marriages.
Romney had also written to the attorneys general of all the other states requiring a statement from them if their states will recognize same-gender marriages. There's been one reported positive response so far. This week, New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer sent Romney the opinion he'd issued in March that New York should recognize legal marriages of gays and lesbians performed outside its borders. That opinion, which also found those marriages could not be legally contracted within New York, was issued in response to marriages performed in the town of New Paltz. Rhode Island should be responding shortly, following a request for an opinion by a gay couple there.
But the door was slammed shut by New Hampshire Governor Craig Benson this week as he signed into law a measure to explicitly deny legal recognition to same-gender marriages performed outside the state. New Hampshire law already restricted its own marriages exclusively to heterosexual couples. The new law also creates a legislative committee to review state statutes towards the possibility of civil unions.
The Missouri state legislature this week sent on to voters a proposed state constitutional amendment against same-gender marriages. The General Assembly acted in the final hour of its session to put the measure on the November ballot by a margin of 5-1. Missouri already has in place a so-called defense of marriage law denying legal recognition to same-gender marriages performed elsewhere.
A proposed amendment to the Tennessee state constitution against same-gender marriages won preliminary approval last week. 95% of the state house supported the move, but it requires several additional votes in both chambers and cannot reach the ballot any sooner than 2006.
Oklahoma voters are already slated to consider a constitutional amendment in November against same-gender marriage. But now those concerns have been carried a step further there. Last week, Governor Brad Henry signed into law a bill to deny legal recognition to adoptions granted to gay and lesbian couples by other states. Oklahoma will continue to recognize one gay or lesbian adoptive parent.
U.S. state lawmakers have been at work on other issues as well. This week, a Hawaii move to make sexual orientation a category protected from housing discrimination died in a House-Senate conference committee. Each chamber had approved a different version of the bill, but senators and representatives could not agree on how broadly religious groups and individuals should be exempted.
New Mexico's new civil rights protections for lesbi, gays, and transgenders are not subject to a repeal initiative, State Attorney General Patricia Madrid said in an opinion issued this week. A petition is already circulating to put the repeal question on the November ballot there. Madrid believes that the law passed last year falls into a group exempted from repeal initiatives under the state constitution, laws providing for the preservation of the public peace, health, or safety. She said the anti-discrimination law represents an exercise of the state's inherent police powers. Although that opinion is technically considered non-binding, it means the initiative is unlikely to reach the voters unless a court rules otherwise. The Human Rights Act, enacted last year, covers employment, housing, credit, public accommodations, and union membership.
Canadian David Reimer, raised as a girl after a circumcision accident, but later choosing more surgery and life as a man, killed himself last week. Under the pseudonym Joan, Reimer was for 20 years medical literature's poster child for the social determination of gender, with his twin brother as a perfect experimental control. But it took heavy slanting for those medical reports to present Reimer as a happy, healthy girl. In fact, he did not adjust well to a female role, was rejected by other children, and suffered physically. On finally learning his history as a teenager, he determined to live as male and went on to marry and become a stepfather. Reimer emerged from anonymity with the publication in 2000 of John Colapinto's book, As Nature Made Him, The Boy Who Was Raised as a Girl, and media appearances including Oprah Winfrey's talk show. He hoped that in doing so, he could save other children from what he had suffered. Lately, his life had taken a grim turn with the death of his twin 2 years ago and the recent loss of his job and separation from his wife, and Reimer was deeply depressed. His mother profoundly regrets having taken that long ago medical advice to give Reimer hormones and raise him as female, and she believes that without that history, he would not have taken his life.
And finally, South Africa this week mourned the death of openly bisexual pop music icon Brenda Fassie at the age of 39. An asthma attack had resulted in cardiac arrest and brain damage that left her comatose for her last 2 weeks. A Xhosa, Fassie was the first major star to rise from one of Cape Town's black townships, Langa, and she never forgot those roots. Her first breakout hit was 1983's Weekend Special. More major hits followed in 1998 and 2000, and another album is due to be released soon. She won numerous African music awards and toured internationally. Her career was something of a roller coaster, due in large part to drug problems that included the overdose death of one of her lesbian lovers. She had many relationships with women, but she paid the traditional bride price for one of her female partners in 1992, and went on to hold a wedding with another a couple of years ago. She confirmed her lesbian identity on television in the early 1990s, and French kissed a woman in the documentary film In Bed with Brenda. South Africa's Lesbian and Gay Equality Project held a memorial event for her in Johannesburg and issued a statement that, in our community, we thank her for entertaining us, but also for supporting our charitable causes. Fassie was an early supporter of South Africa's first president, Nelson Mandela, and Winnie Mandela was present for the first announcement of her death. Among many tributes at her passing, current President Thabo Mbeki said she was not only a South African singer, but a Pan-African griot, making souls rise in bliss wherever her voice reached.
That's News Wrap for the week ending May 15th, 2004. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Dean Elzinger.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
You'll discover that the best-selling memoirs of Augustine Burroughs are funnier than fiction just a bit later in the program. I've only got a couple of minutes to remind you that 2003 was one heck of a queer year, and that we've got the sounds to prove it. Steve Pride recalls the year's most memorable queer-themed offerings on the big and small screen.
Actually contains no sinking ocean liners, no high-speed car chases.
My film is about a few years that I spent pretending to be somebody else before I went to prison.
We're friends of 43 years, and we're lovers of 27 years.
It centers around a gay male couple who are enforcers for the mafia.
You wouldn't even think, you know, 20 years ago, that you ever would have this many gay and lesbian films.
Our film is about Bayard Rustin, this gay African-American civil rights hero.
This is a queer buddy movie.
It's a social, gender, sexuality, drama comedy.
Are you hiding in the potting shed?
I wasn't hiding.
It's all about identity. It's all about visibility.
The producers of Audiophile choose their favorite out music of the year.
I want to double my wardrobe. Leave the seat up late at night.
Say a prayer for me, Sarah.
I like a man who is crazy about me.
Ginger's my favorite thing.
I'll cross into your heart if you cross into mine.
I listen to the wind of my soul.
He's the best darn thing to come down the pike in a good long while. I like Mike.
And there's a keepsake collection of the biggest queer news stories of 2003.
It says intended bridegroom and intended bride. How are intended spouse and intended spouse?
The Supreme Court says that we matter and we're valuable.
Being gay is not a crime.
To press forward with this consecration will be to turn our backs on Almighty God.
It's not about me. It's about so many other people at the margins.
Finally, all families in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts will have the opportunity to be equal families under the law.
One or more of these 2003 queer audio history and culture CDs can be yours. For all the details, log on to thiswayout.org.
I gazed into the mirror, said I'm crazy, turned around and began to smile. I never thought I'd live to 21, but now I think I'll stay a while. Confusion and seclusion run together like a loser runs to crime. My suicide is easy, but a sleazy way to try to beat the time.
The memoirs of queer writer Augustine Burroughs prove yet again that truth is much stranger than fiction. His best-selling Running with Scissors documents a horrifying childhood, while the previously penned sequel Dry, named Best Book of 2003 by The Advocate, recounts his descent into alcoholism. There are two big surprises. The first is that Burroughs survived to write the books. The second is that they're both hilarious. This Way Out's Steve Pride chats with one of Entertainment Weekly's 25 funniest people in America.
There are very few originals in the world. Augustine Burroughs is one. His memoir, Running with Scissors, and its sequel, Dry, are horrific and yet screamingly funny. That's a pretty neat trick.
I'm Augustine Burroughs.
Augustine, it's nice to meet you, but I just finished reading your books back to back, and I feel like I already know you.
Yeah, I get that a lot, because both of the books are so intimate. They're just excruciatingly personal. So it's not uncommon for me to be walking down the street, to be recognized by somebody, and have that particular somebody come up and say, you know, Augustine? And then go into an incredibly personal, often horrifying story about themselves.
For people that haven't yet read Running with Scissors, tell us about your very unique childhood.
It started off normal enough. You know, I had two academic parents. My father was the head of the mathematics department at the University of Massachusetts, and my mother was working on her graduate studies in creative writing. Things started to go wrong when I was about 8. My parents had a really unhappy marriage, and that's not so uncommon. You know, that's not memoir material. You know, they fought a lot. What began to happen was that my mother's brain sort of rewired itself, and she began to go crazy. She was a poet, and I think she began to identify a little too strongly with Anne Sexton. And in order to save their marriage, my mother and father began to see this psychiatrist named Dr. Finch. They went for weekly therapy sessions, and, you know, it didn't work, as it doesn't work a lot of the time. So my parents divorced. My mother began to see Dr. Finch every week and then, you know, a few times a week. And then I began to see Dr. Finch. And he looked like Santa Claus. That was my first impression of him. He was a short, big guy with white hair and a white beard and big, white, bristly eyebrows. And he was very charismatic, and he sort of talked like this. And he was a very sort of captivating guy, a lot of charisma. He was also insane, sort of Charles Manson, I guess, without the machete. And my mother became just in this odd sort of symbiotic relationship with him, and gave him all sort of control of her mind. So she went completely crazy, could not take care of me anymore. And when I say crazy, I mean she was, you know, having to be hospitalized in mental hospital. She would have psychotic episodes. You know, she was hallucinating, and she was hearing voices, and she was seeing things, and she was smoking cigarettes in the bathroom with her dead grandfather. She was literally crazy. And I started spending more and more time with the doctor. And over time, I began to spend some time at the doctor's house. And the doctor's house was this dilapidated pink, peeling, falling apart Victorian in Northampton, Massachusetts, which is a very pristine, well-heeled college town, Smith College. And the street was beautiful, you know, with one beautiful house after another, and then this eyesore of a house with a dirt lawn and a falling down barn in the back. And the doctor's family lived there. He had like 6 kids and patients and adopted children, you know. And it was a large, large, busy house. And he had this beaten down sort of martyr of a wife. And the doctor had a daughter, Natalie, who was around my age, and she was this very precocious, kind of ratty, greasy, funny girl, and her slightly older sister. And we would play. And basically what happened was one day my mother said, "You're going to live here from now on." And so when I was 13, she signed me over, legal guardianship, to this doctor. This was a place where there was no school. That was it for school. There were no rules. There was no structure. I mean, you know, there was no bedtime. There was nothing that you think of as normal, you know, nothing that you think of as the way things are supposed to be. I mean, we were really wild, sort of loose kids left to our own devices, sort of Pippi Longstocking, but darker in a way. The doctor's kids were all very eccentric. I mean, they were very, very, very highly energized and sexualized. And I felt like a little nerd because I was this little prissy thing, you know, in my polyester slacks. And here I was suddenly in this house with just dog hair everywhere and squalor and just kind of filth and loud shouting. They were very confrontational, you know. So I had to sort of shapeshift to become one of these people suddenly. And there was a guy, the doctor's adopted son, Neil, lived in the barn behind the house. And he was 33. And we became lovers, if you can call it that.
How old were you at that time?
I was 13. Basically, what happened was that I had confided to the doctor's secretary and second oldest daughter, Hope. You know, I told her I was gay. And she basically felt, you know, you should talk to my brother, Neil, because so is he. So Neil and I developed this friendship based on me sort of coming out to him and telling him about what was going on with me and how I felt abandoned and I was gay and all these sort of problems that I was feeling at the time. And it took me a long time to realize actually what happened. I say that we developed a sexual relationship, but it wasn't actually quite that simple. As I talk about in the book, there was a pretty violent sort of rape scene. He lived in the barn, then he moved out to his own apartment in a town nearby, East Hampton. And I went up to look at some photographs that he had, and he just raped me, you know. And then he said, "There, you still think you're gay?" And I just remember feeling just pure hatred toward this guy. I hated him, and I just wanted to kill him. But that's not what happened. What happened is that he became obsessed with me, and he was tortured by the fact that he was obsessed with a 13-year-old. The power dynamic shifted in the relationship, and he became sort of like this dog that I had, that I could tell him to do anything, and he would do it. It's a happy story in the sense that, I mean, I survived it. And the way I survived it was I retreated into my own internal world. I wrote in journals all the time. I carried these spiral 5-subject notebooks, and I would just focus on the page and write what was happening to me. And that was how I got through it. And there was a lot of also fun. There was always something happening. The doctor was fond of having parades. So he would, you know, tie us up in balloons and, you know, go celebrate World Father's Day. One thing the doctor also did is he felt that God spoke to him through the toilet. The shape of people's bowels, their turds in the toilet, would indicate our future. So he was going through this phase where he would do toilet bowl readings of his daughters. And I mean, there's just this stuff that's just so gross and vile and ridiculous that, I mean, you had to laugh at it. When things are that catastrophically terrible in your life, there's a certain point where, you know what, it's just funny.
You are listening to This Way Out Radio Magazine. I am Steve Pride, and we are speaking with Augustine Burroughs, author of Dry and Running with Scissors. Augustine, when I finished reading Running with Scissors, I was so hopeful that the next chapter of your life, which you chronicle in the book Dry, would document a happier time for you.
Dry picks up more or less where Running with Scissors left off. And what actually happened to me is that I got into advertising as a copywriter, and I got it. I understood it because, you know, you'd have someone come along, some company, some manufacturer, and they, you know, theoretically they say to you, you know, we've got this toothpaste that we think is pretty great, but here's the problem. If you brush your teeth with it 4 times a day, it's going to cause mouth cancer and you're going to lose your jaw. And I look at that and I think, okay, great. Hey, now there's a toothpaste and just brush your teeth once a day. I always see the positive side. And that's why I was so good at advertising and I was really successful and I loved it, you know? And it was like, yeah, give me your exploding car, you know? Give me your Band-Aid that causes a rash. I could find the plus side, the positive spin. So now I was living in New York and I was making money. And I mean, I was just like, you know, bring on the martinis. And that's basically what it was like for me. I mean, I was working in advertising, having a great time and drinking hard all the time. Yeah, to have fun and go out, definitely, and go to bars because I was really shy. I could never meet guys unless I was drunk. And I could never go to a gay bar unless I was drunk. And I could never talk to anybody unless I was drunk. But also because if I let myself just sit for 5 minutes without having to write an ad and without having a drink in my hand, I got sad and I got worried and I got scared because I felt so damaged. I felt so flawed that if I looked at it for more than 5 seconds, it was going to crush me. Now, the thing about alcohol that I discovered is that it's really great in a lot of ways. You know, it's definitely a social lubricant and it makes you less inhibited and it really is a lot of fun. I don't regret drinking. I had a great time. I loved it. It made me so uninhibited that I had experiences I never would have had, but I'm kind of glad I had them. But eventually, the physiology took over, and I became one of these people who used to reek of alcohol in the morning. So, you know, it came to a point where I had to be fired or go to rehab. So I was confronted, you know, at a job, and, you know, so I went out. I shipped myself off to a gay rehab center in Minneapolis thinking, oh, this is going to be like a spa, you know, Ian Schrager. It's going to be really swanky. I'm going to have 400 cotton Egyptian sheets on the bed, you know, and large glass pitchers of ice water with lemon, and it's going to be just terrific. And, you know, it was horrible. It was just horrible. It was hospital with fluorescent lights and magic markers with boards. And it was like medical school for alcoholics with a bunch of gay guys who all had like let their hair go and were like looking just like crap. Sorriest group of fags you ever saw collected in a room. And surly dykes just sitting there. Happy hour was so over. And so I'm in rehab. And now all this stuff I didn't want to think about, I got to think about. I mean, I want to check out immediately. And for the first 3 days, every day, I was there hour by hour. Eventually, you know, some of it started to make sense. I started to realize, yeah, okay, all these people around me that are all freaks and serious rock-bottom alcoholics, of which I, by the way, am not, all of a sudden I realize I have kind of everything in common with them. I mean, I have my apartment back home in New York filled with 1,300 empty bottles of Dewars, which, when I was living with it, seemed fine. The apartment was complete squalor, and I'm making 6 figures, and I'm in advertising, and I'm wearing an Armani suit, and I'm coming home, and I'm sleeping in sheets that I had peed in the night before, and there are fruit flies rotting all over the apartment, and I have this collection of bottles. And when you live like that, when you're in the middle of it, as anyone out there listening who does live like that can tell you it doesn't matter because you don't see it. You know, I was focused on the computer, so I didn't see it. And it kind of becomes like a comfortable bird's nest. You know, you pad the filth and squalor down. You make a path from the bed to the refrigerator to the bathroom to your desk, and, you know, you don't see it. But if I heard anybody in the hall, I remember I would freeze and be perfectly quiet because I didn't want them to knock on the door because I could not open the door. I could not open the door. I was not a writer with a capital W when I wrote Dry. I was just a guy who was a mess, who got out of rehab and all of a sudden realized there are a lot more hours in the day than there used to be. Now I'm feeling the minutes, you know, it's like, okay, I'm sober. It's 4:30 in the afternoon. I'm sober. This is terrific. Time passes. It's 4:37. I'm sober. And this goes on one day, day by day, for the rest of your life. I mean, I was going crazy. That's the thing they don't tell you in rehab. They don't tell you you're going to get sober and you're going to get a whole lot of hours every day and you're not going to know what to do with it and you're going to go crazy, you know, and they say, go to a meeting. Well, that's great. But a meeting is an hour, you know. What about the other 23? So I, not knowing what to do, reverted to my old childhood ways and I began to write. And I began writing on the day I got out of rehab. And I didn't stop. And I just like to tell people, you know, wasn't that long ago. I have not been writing for 20 years. I have not been writing for 15 years. You know, this is since 1999. This is 1999 is when all, you know, this sort of started. The before and the after of my life is just stunning. The reinvention that occurred as a result of not drinking, you know, as a result of just of not doing that. That's what has been sort of the V8 moment. Wow, I could have had a V8 on a profound level. That's what it's been like. Just realizing, man, you know, I wasted so much time.
This has been a conversation with Augustine Burroughs, author of Dry and Running with Scissors. In April, the paperback editions of both were number 4 and 5, respectively, on the New York Times bestseller list. Augustine Burroughs is also the author of the best-selling novel, Cellavision. For more information, point your internet browser to augustine.com or prideonscreen.com. I'm Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Well, yesterday was vanity. I used too much profanity. Tomorrow damns humanity. Oh, yeah. But today's a little better. I'm a little less insane. Yesterday is littered with my innocent remains. Today's a little better, I'm not trying to run away. Not feeling quite as bitter, it's a little bit of better every day.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Dean Elzinga, Graham Underhill, Fensberry, Rex Walkner, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Thanks also to J.D. Doyle. Paxton performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by grants from Clarissa Pinkola Estes, La Sociedad de Guadalupe Foundation, and the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, and through direct charitable donations from our listeners, and we thank you. You too can help keep this program on the air and get some queer audio history, music, and culture CDs in return. For all the details, log on to thiswayout.org or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks very much for listening on KOMY Monterey, California, CFUV Victoria, British Columbia, WRUV Burlington, Vermont, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Next time, the sounds of Massachusetts matrimony, so be sure to stay tuned.